From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Bush administration is on the record with doubts about the media-filtered news, but no problem. If you don't like somebody else's news, make your own.
The televised images from Baghdad prompted celebrations from Iraqi Americans all across the United States. They seem to revel in the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime as much as they did in Baghdad. USA!
USA! USA! That's a report produced after the fall of Saddam Hussein and made available to any TV station that wanted to run it. But it wasn't produced by journalists. It was produced by public relations professionals working for the State Department.
It looks like journalism and it sounds like journalism, but it's actually a video news release, a gussied-up commercial used for years by pharmaceutical companies and other corporate entities to slip product ads or spin into TV newscasts. And in recent times, governments have gotten in on the act, state and federal, Democrat and Republican. We've reported on the technique before, but last Sunday, the New York Times ran a front-page bombshell that made us gasp. The article revealed that not two, not five, but at least 20 federal agencies have produced VNRs over the past 4 years as part of a $250 million public relations effort by the Bush administration. The spots range from nakedly political, like the one we just heard, to innocuous, like this one from the Census Bureau.
Safety experts say all that traffic congestion can be dangerous, especially during holidays like Independence Day.
July 4th, particularly when it comes on a weekend, which it does this year, has the highest number of deaths typically of any day of the year.
Experts offer a simple message. Wear seatbelts, cut down on distractions like cell phones, and of course, don't drink and drive. In Washington, I'm Jane Wattrell reporting.
Jane Wattrell? Not a reporter. She just plays one on TV, as did Karen Ryan, whose fake news packages on the Bush administration's controversial changes in Medicare reached millions of TV viewers last year.
But is the practice kosher? The Bush administration said yes. The Congressional Government Accountability Office reviewed the Medicare VNR and said no. Susan Poling is Associate General Counsel for the GAO. Propaganda may be older than the printing press, but she says the VNR posed some brand new questions.
It was a novelty to us. We had never seen one before. And when we looked at it, we had some concerns.
Were any laws broken in its preparation and distribution?
Well, there's an Appropriations Act that prohibits the use of appropriated funds for publicity or propaganda purposes. And over many years, the GAO has interpreted this to prohibit materials that are self-aggrandizing, purely partisan in nature, or covert as to source. And after looking at this particular video news release, which is a complete story, it looks exactly like the local TV station produced it. We found that it was covert as to the source.
And specifically, what did your office do?
We explained the reasons why we found this to violate the publicity or propaganda prohibition. Later, we received another request having to do with the Office of National Drug Control Policy. And after we made the same finding with regard to that particular prepackaged news story, the Comptroller General thought that it might be a good idea to let other agencies know that they may also be having problems in this area. And so in February of this year, he sent out a circular letter to the heads of departments, which indicated that the way to avoid this is to disclose to the target audience, which was the television viewing audience, that this was made or produced with taxpayer dollars.
Lo and behold, however, the Justice Department looked at your decision and took a strikingly different view and said, hold on, we actually disagree with the GAO. Tell me about the Justice Department's ruling.
Well, the Justice Department decided that a prepackaged news story also needed to be an advocacy piece before it would violate the publicity or propaganda prohibition. And they took as a given, without looking at the HHS prepackaged news story, they took as a given that this was, in fact, purely informational. Those are their words.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Just the facts, ma'am.
So what do you make of the distinction that they're drawing between propaganda and information?
We didn't choose to go by defining propaganda. Propaganda is a little bit in the eyes of the beholder. One person's information or facts is another person's propaganda. In a prepackaged news story, an agency is emphasizing some facts and leaving others out. It's just by the nature of anyone who sits down and writes something, they tell you some things, they don't tell you other things. When you can evaluate what the source is, then you can help decide for yourself what information you're getting. So we believe that it's truly the covert nature of this that pushes it over into propaganda, because if the material were properly identified, we would say it is informational.
The administration this week continued to defend its use of VNRs, saying that the agencies that distribute them are clearly labeling them as coming from the government. The labels, of course, are outside of the package, like, you know, stamped on the box. Is that a persuasive argument for you that, well, sure, they're labeled. There's the label right there.
Well, our opinion states that the target audience must receive the notification. And the target audience of the prepackaged news story is not the television studio itself. It's the television viewer. And unless it's there for the television viewer to see, then they are not properly labeled.
When there is a disagreement between the GAO and the executive branch, who becomes the arbiter? Does this head for the courts?
In all likelihood, this is not something that would end up in the courts. This is a difference of view between the executive branch and the legislative branch. While we have the statutory authority to address the federal agency's use of appropriated funds, GAO does not have enforcement authority. But we do expect agencies to act in accordance with our appropriations law decisions. And we hope that the executive branch will do what is reasonable, responsible, and right.
Don't wish your life away. Susan Poling, thank you very much.
I'm glad to be here.
Susan Poling is Managing Associate General Counsel at the Government Accountability Office.
At a press conference Wednesday, President Bush was asked about his administration's widespread and continuing use of video news releases. Here's what he had to say.
I think it'd be helpful if local stations then disclose to their viewers if that's, you know, that this was based upon a factual report and they chose to use it. But evidently, in some cases, that's not the case. So anyway,
the administration should guarantee that's happening by including that language in the prepackaged report.
Yeah, I don't, you know, look. I mean, oh, you mean a disclosure? I'm George W. Bush, and I.
Well, some way to make sure it couldn't air without the disclosure that you believe is so vital.
You know, Ken, I mean, there's a procedure that we're going to follow, and the local stations ought to, if there's a deep concern about that, ought to tell their viewers what they're watching.
So the president is putting all the onus on broadcasters. Joining us now is Barbara Cochran, head of the Radio and Television News Directors Association. So, Barbara, as a broadcast representative, what say you?
Well, there is a responsibility of broadcasters to examine very closely when they're going to use this material, what context they're going to use it in, and then if they do use it, to label it clearly. That is definitely the journalist's responsibility. But that still doesn't take away from the fact that this material is now flooding into stations from all different directions, not always clear as to the origin of this material. And there's got to be some government responsibility, too.
There are plenty of stations who run these spots and know exactly what they're doing, at least according to the Times. The Times found that some programmers were clipping off the out cue, identifying the fake reporter as a government contractor, and others who had their own reporters re-record the VNR narration in their own voice.
I don't think we really know how prevalent that is. I mean, I've done a little investigating and know that, for example, that the New York Times may have identified reports from a reporter appearing on a particular station, but in fact, that reporter works for a lot of different people, including the news service that that station subscribes to. So just finding that reporter's work on their air doesn't mean that it necessarily came from the government. every news director that I've spoken to is very clear that their policy is that this material needs to be labeled. Now, whether the producer working the weekend shift or the producer working the early morning shift is always aware of that policy, or even if they know where this material is coming from, that's the question, and that's where all news departments have to do a good job of trying to reinforce this policy.
I understand that individual stations draw up their own policies on the use of VNRs, but if you had the power to craft one that would apply to all newsrooms across the country, what would it say? Would any VNRs be allowed to run?
Well, I do think that VNRs do sometimes contain useful information. One example is the material that's put out by NASA when they show what a space shot looks like, or there might be some information about food safety or other kinds of consumer safety issues. But again, it needs to be included in something that is reported and originated by the journalists at that station. And if a government video news release is used, it needs to be clearly labeled.
Now, some activists and Democratic lawmakers are calling on the FCC to crack down on the use of government VNRs. Do you think there's any chance that there could be an FCC crackdown? And would that be a good thing?
I think that this is something that stations need to solve for themselves. It's in the station's interest to protect its credibility.
So the president of the RTNDA would never advocate additional rules coming from the FCC. I understand that. On the other hand, though the RTNDA has a policy, it has absolutely no way to enforce it and not even any way to monitor these infractions. So broadcasters can continue to play these things without consequences.
You know, I think, again, the number of instances in which this material has actually been used are so few, relatively speaking, compared to all the information that goes out over the air all the time on so many local television stations.
It may be small, the use of these VNRs, in relation to the huge amount of broadcast material out there. But for many local viewers, a government-produced VNR may be the only way they learn about changes in Medicare, or the only way they learn about how the Pentagon trains military police. And if they're coming from the government, it doesn't matter if it's a tiny part of the broadcast day. It could be their sole source of information, and it's tainted.
Certainly, if they're going to use that material, they need to put it into a context. That's what independent news people do. I think the attention that this issue is getting now is going to cause everyone to look at their policy. And what they need to think about is their credibility. And if the public comes to think that this news is being generated by sources who have an interest in what those stories are, then they're going to start to distrust the local news. That's why it's so important to be clear about this.
Well, Barbara, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barbara Cochran is president of the Radio and Television News Directors Association.
Coming up, lawmakers and journalists unite to put the focus on a place where the sun don't shine, Washington.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This was Sunshine Week, designated as such by news organizations, universities, legislators, bloggers, and advocacy groups around the country who want us to celebrate and safeguard the public's right to know. There have been editorials printed, conferences convened, and rallying cries aplenty for citizens to do their part to ensure that the government comes out of the shadows and into the light.
On behalf of Sunshine Week, the Ipsos Public Affairs Research Center conducted a poll that shows 70% of Americans, quote, are concerned about government secrecy. It ran a similar poll in 2000 with similar results. It turns out 9/11 did not change the way we think about government openness. Although Americans are concerned about national security, it seems that they don't feel safer when they are kept in the dark.
Several measures designed to combat excessive secrecy have been floated on Capitol Hill. Among them are two bills co-sponsored by Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy and Republican Senator John Cornyn. The first is the Open Government Act, designed to reinvigorate the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA. For decades, people have filed FOIA requests to gain access to government documents, but as you've heard noted on this show many times, the flow of documents from FOIA requests has slowed to a trickle in recent years. Senator Cornyn of Texas says it's beyond time to unclog that pipeline.
Well, that's right. Yeah, the Freedom of Information Act was passed in 1966, and the last oversight hearing Congress has had on the Freedom of Information Act was 1992, so it needs a little tune-up.
But there is another piece of legislation that you're sponsoring, and that's called the Faster FOIA Act of 2005. So what would that accomplish that the first bill doesn't?
Well, the Faster FOIA Act would create a 16-member commission to look at the reasons for delays in government responses to Freedom of Information requests. I came from the Attorney General's office in Texas, where I was the one responsible for interpreting and enforcing our Open Records Act. But when I came to Washington, I found a different attitude entirely and heard horror stories about people who had made requests and still waiting for a response years later.
How long?
In many instances, 7-8 years. There's simply no incentive for people to comply with the deadlines set out in the Freedom of Information Act. And what Senator Leahy, my co-sponsor, and I try to do in a bipartisan way is to provide incentives, to provide additional training, to provide for an ombudsman that would assist both the requester and the agency to try to work out differences, and then if all else fails, to provide for the recovery of some attorney's fees if government remained obstinate and didn't comply with the law.
Why do you think FOIA is so backed up now? Do you think it's due to a lack of staff and resources, or is it just plain stonewalling? Because we do know that John Ashcroft, when he was head of the Justice Department, sent a directive saying that the emphasis should be on reasons why to release that information rather than, as was formerly, reasons why not.
Well, you're right, and unfortunately, I think it was perhaps an overreaction post 9/11. I think that the presumption ought to be in favor of openness, and if there's justification for keeping it closed, then it ought to be on the government to provide that justification, not to put the burden on the requester, as is the current situation.
Other than proposing legislation, what do you think the role of Congress is in all of this? I'm talking about oversight. Mm. We've spoken to a lot of investigative journalists who feel very frustrated that Congress has done a far poorer job than it used to in providing oversight. I wonder how your colleagues feel about the Faster FOIA Act and the Open Government Act. Do you think they'll be with you on it?
Well, I certainly hope so. We voted the Faster FOIA Act out of the Judiciary Committee, and my hope is that with very little additional work, we're able to get it passed out of the Senate. And I don't know who is telling you about the glory days of the past when Congress used to do more extensive oversight. I can tell you just about my experience in the last couple of years, and that there's simply not enough time for Congress under their current practice to do the kind of oversight that I would like. But the fact is that congressional oversight is a poor substitute for open government.
It's very interesting that your bill allows the FOIA fees to be waived or reduced for bloggers and other writers on the web, just as they are for journalists. So will then bloggers be treated as mainstream journalists?
It's harder and harder to determine who is actually qualified to act as a journalist, and certainly it's not government's responsibility to try to decide who is and who is not. But clearly bloggers have entered into the mainstream. They, as citizen activists, not necessarily as professional journalists, need to be able to get access to information as well.
Now, as you mentioned, Patrick Leahy was your co-sponsor on this bill and on the other bill, but he's also proposing a third bill related to freedom of information that would basically get rid of a post 9/11 law that exempts private companies from having to disclose so-called critical infrastructure information submitted to the Homeland Security Department. In practice, companies have been taking advantage of this exemption to shield themselves from all sorts of public scrutiny. Why aren't you on board with that one?
Well, I'm still looking at that, and I may eventually be. And, of course, you described it accurately. It was part of the act that created the Department of Homeland Security. I recognize that there is need for public access to information, but honestly, we don't want to let our enemies get information that they can use to hurt us. So in a post 9/11 world, I think that calls for some caution. But on the other hand, I think, as evidenced by the other two bills that Senator Leahy and I are on, that we recognize that there is a broad consensus that there is too much secrecy generally and too little justification.
Senator, thanks so much for your time.
I certainly appreciate it. Take care.
Senator John Cornyn is the Republican sponsor of the Cornyn-Leahy Faster FOIA Act and the Open Government Act.
This week, the president announced that Kevin Martin was his choice for chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, and since Martin is currently on the FCC, he doesn't need to be confirmed by the Senate. Thus, the person who has the most influence on who owns the media and who's on it slips into his chair, pretty much with no questions asked. Long allied with the White House, Martin served as legal counsel to George W. Bush during the 2000 campaign. In the 4 years he served on the FCC, Martin has proved to be a whiz at coalition building and a hawk on indecency. Bill McConnell is a senior writer for Broadcasting and Cable magazine. He joins us once again. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, a coalition building whiz, which I suppose means that he's on friendly terms with Democratic commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein. That's a kind of an interesting role for a well-known ally of President Bush.
Well, what sets Kevin Martin apart from his predecessor Michael Powell is that he is more willing to engage his fellow commissioners in developing sort of the early stages of FCC policy. Powell rankled a lot of his colleagues because he would sort of keep his ideas close to his chest while they were under development and then just lay them on the table when it was time for a vote. Kevin himself bristled under that sort of regime, and a couple times he reached out to his Democratic colleagues on the commission to really essentially perform a coup against Michael Powell.
Yeah, tell me about the policy issues in which he did find common cause with the Democrats.
He was certainly of like mind with Democrat Michael Copps on the indecency crackdown. Although Powell got a lot of press as sort of being the instigator of all this, it was really political pressure that got Powell moving on that. Martin, on the other hand, really does support the idea of the indecency crackdown, as did Michael Copps and to a lesser extent Jonathan Adelstein, both Democrats. Also, I think Kevin is more of a like mind with the Democrats on trying to find ways that will preserve localism in broadcasting, although Kevin does differ with the Democrats on whether to allow more media consolidation itself.
Well, let's talk about media consolidation. The FCC's initiatives to make it easier for large media companies to own more and more were reversed by the Congress and the courts. Do you think Martin will try to pick up that ball?
Well, he'll have to, because the deregulation that was approved by the FCC in 2003 has been remanded back to the FCC for a rewrite. It'll be interesting to see how Martin takes that up. He was very supportive of deregulation in 2003. You would think that this latest court decision sort of hamstrings him a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see if he is able to pursue the agenda he wants and still sort of navigate the court ruling.
Commissioner Powell took it on the chin over the question of indecency, taking the blame for what some believe is a puritanical stance on the part of the FCC to regulate content. But in fact, Commissioner Martin was much more of an activist on that subject than the previous chairman himself.
That's correct. He would have liked to have imposed higher fines on a lot of the broadcasters who were fined this year. He has also said that the broadcaster should do more voluntarily by reinstituting a family viewing time across all of the networks every night during prime time. This is something that Martin, I think, will keep the pressure on and really have his heart and a lot of enthusiasm in the effort.
Including his advocacy for the regulation of content for cable and satellite, which puzzles me because they are not broadcast on the public spectrum and therefore, I thought, out of the purview of the FCC.
Kevin has kind of avoided that issue in the past couple of weeks and hasn't really spelled out what he's thinking in that area. Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Ted Stevens has said cable ought to be regulated pretty much in the same way broadcasters are. In the past week, Stevens has kind of backed off of that, although some of his fellow lawmakers on the Commerce Committee have picked up the ball and said, yeah, let's go full speed ahead. I think Martin, on the issue of cable and satellite, is willing to let Congress take the lead as well as take the heat on that issue.
One thing you can say about Michael Powell is that he was more or less consistent. He was not all that eager to impose large indecency fines because of his laissez-faire libertarian philosophy and the same way that he was more or less hands-off on media consolidation. Kevin Martin, he's historically quite bullish on the regulation of content, which flies very much in the face of a deregulatory environment for media consolidation. How does he square that circle?
I think his views are sort of reflective of sort of the internal contradiction in the Republican Party itself. There are a lot of Republicans who are laissez-faire libertarian, especially in their focus on economics. There's another wing of the Republican Party that is more the family values crowd and is not really afraid of regulating social behavior, including the way the media behaves. So I think Kevin's a little more reflective of that contradiction in the GOP itself.
Help me get inside the new commissioner's head. It has been suggested in print that his ability to get along with his Democratic colleagues was less indicative of an open mind than of a sort of Machiavellian scheming to advance himself to the chairmanship. Do you think that's fair?
To an extent, it is. Kevin Martin certainly knows how to open political opportunities for himself. He got into this job at the FCC because of his ties to the Bush White House that he developed as a Bush campaign lawyer in 2000. He was one of the organizers of the vote recount in Florida. He worked so tirelessly on all of this that he left his car in Austin, Texas on election night, flew straight to Florida and then to Washington. And his car stayed in Austin, Texas that whole time. And his dad eventually had to go pick it up with a friend, drove all the way from North Carolina only to find out that Kevin's battery was dead. So Kevin has been very focused on how to make President Bush look good and how to make Kevin Martin look good.
Okay. Well, Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Bill McConnell is a senior writer for Broadcasting and Cable.
The Project for Excellence in Journalism has released its exhaustive annual report on American journalism, and we were drawn to its assessment of the coverage of the war in Iraq on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. The cable news channels, it turns out, didn't have all that much in common when it came to things like balance, use of anonymous sources, or the ratio of straight reporting to opinion. Now we know with scientific exactitude which cable channel offered the most one-sided opinionated war coverage by far. Here with the shocking results is... Nah, just kidding. Here to inform us of the obvious is PEJ's senior associate Dante Chinney. Welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me on.
So part of your study focuses on the major cable news channels. Now, time was when we expected TV anchors and reporters to give us the news without adding their opinions. Could you compare the performances of CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News?
Well, they're just very different news products. When you look at the opinion, we're talking about anchors or reporters actually giving views on the stories they're talking about. 4% of the time you'd find opinion in a CNN piece, 27% of the time you'd find opinion in pieces on MSNBC, and 68% of the time you find it on Fox.
Yowza. Now, Fox has a reputation for being skewed to the right. You did the research. Does the data tell us which station is most lopsided in its coverage?
Fox puts a lot of opinion in there, but we didn't look at those specific opinions to see if they leaned to the right or to the left. The one thing we did look at was the coverage of the Iraq war and determine whether it's positive or negative, whether things are going good or poorly in Iraq. And CNN and MSNBC, it was pretty evenly split between positive pieces about Iraq and negative pieces about Iraq. But Fox, it really stood out that there was a big discrepancy. There was much more positive and much less negative. They're positive and they're no opinion or no slant was about even. Their negative was much, much lower.
And how did you measure it?
We're looking at three different time periods. We looked at the afternoon or the daytime shows. Then we tried to look at their signature newscast, which for Fox was Brit Hume, for CNN was Aaron Brown, and for MSNBC was Keith Olbermann's show. And then we also looked at their evening talk shows. So that would be Bill O'Reilly, Larry King, and Chris Matthews. What we do is go through the stories and code them for language. And we didn't do this ourselves. We have researchers up in Princeton who do a lot of the hard work for us. All together, talking about newspapers, cable, network, online, we coded some 17,000 stories.
And hundreds of hours of television programming.
Absolutely.
Now, you already mentioned that Fox tends to be more positive in the coverage of the Iraq war than CNN and MSNBC. Mm-hmm. But what about other measurements of good reporting, like, for instance, sourcing?
Fox does a better job of explaining who the sources are and telling you who's telling them what they're hearing. CNN does less a good job of that. However, Fox's sources also tend to be much more one-sided. Their reports tend to be much more one-sided than the reports on CNN. So in other words, CNN, you may not know who's telling you what you're hearing, but it's more balanced. Fox, you know where you're getting it from, but it's coming more from one side.
Right. Well, we had heard in dispatches from the war that Fox News reporters were able to get to generals and people in the field a lot faster than, say, CNN's reporters could.
Yes.
So they just have a better relationship with the administration.
Well, you could argue that, absolutely.
Is there any evidence to suggest that we, as news consumers, actually prefer this mix of commentary with news a la Fox to the straight news variety? After all, it is Fox News that seems to be gaining viewers.
Fox would argue that the ratings are the proof, and they would say yes. Fox has made a very conscious decision to do what they're doing. But CNN's counter is, yes, if you look at the ratings, Fox has higher ratings than we do. But if you were to go through the month and look at the cumulative ratings, that is, individuals tuning in to each station over the course of the month, CNN actually has more. And they suggest, obviously, what that means is the people who view CNN are coming by to get the news. They get the news and they leave, or they click by to catch headlines and they leave. Fox's viewers are much more like, it's a talk radio model of how these things operate, where you tune in and I'm watching this because I have a relationship with this network. We see the world in the same way, kind of thing.
So to recap, Fox offers more lopsided news, or at least it did on the war, and far more opinion, not labeled as opinion, in its newscasts. So what would the Project for Excellence in Journalism do with the Fox slogan, "We report, you decide"?
They themselves have even backed away from it a little bit and now say fair and balanced, which is obviously a little bit trickier term, fair to whom and balanced as compared to what. But yeah, "we report, you decide" might have to be "we spin and you determine what you want."
Or "we report and decide"?
It's a lot easier. You don't have to change as many words that way.
Dante Cheney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dante Cheney is a senior associate with the Project for Excellence in Journalism. The full report can be found at the website stateofthemedia.org.
Coming up, a tale of two countries, how the news is delivered in Lebanon and Jordan.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. Women's e-news, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. John Solomon's report on guns in the media prompted a huge response from listeners. Jeff Hinson of Columbia, Maryland writes, "I'm an avid outdoorsman trapped in the urban world. John Solomon got it right. It's the first time in my life that I actually listened to a reporter telling a story about guns and gun owners that didn't offend me. Please pass my compliments on to Mr. Solomon and tell him he's welcome in my tree stand, duck blind, trap house, or hunting camp anytime."
NRA Life member Robert Childs from Dallas, Texas, writes that the report was, quote, "the best explanation of the issue I have heard in the last four decades. Too often, journalists unknowingly display their lack of knowledge regarding firearms merely by the nomenclature they use. If a reporter lacks the desire or motivation to do even the most rudimentary research on the subject, is it any surprise that firearm owners perceive them as at best slipshod and hackneyed, if not outright biased? Although the average person might think it trivial to expect reporters to distinguish between such mechanisms as semi- and fully automatic firearms, the difference can be substantial when it relates to the legislative and criminal justice systems. Sometimes the difference is as much as 10 years in a federal penitentiary."
Pat Majerski of Chicago, Illinois, was glad our report dispelled some of the stereotypes about gun owners, but notes that stereotypes about gun control advocates must also disappear. Quote, "it would serve the debate if your reporter would accompany a hunting enthusiast to a community that has been ravaged by gun violence so that the enthusiast can see that the gun control advocates do not have hunters in mind when they plead for gun legislation, but safety. In the past week, no less than 13 senseless deaths by gun violence have been at the top of the national news. It is critically important for the media to address the concerns of both sides of this debate honestly and stop feeding the dangerous stereotypes that prevent a sensible debate on gun control in the United States."
I'm sorry, writes Marissa Blackwell of California, but I'm not sympathetic at all to gun owners. It may be fun to go and shoot clay ducks, as your reporter did, but that's a far cry from shooting an innocent animal out of the sky. Would we condone that if you replace the animal with your beloved dog Fido or cat Boots? I think not.
Thanks to all who wrote. Keep those emails coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Ever since the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut in 1983, Lebanon has been etched in the minds of Americans as a dangerous mix of factions and infighting, with Christians, Druze, Sunni, and Shia, Syria, Hezbollah, and opposition forces, and no one in the majority. It's hard for Western media to untangle the threads. Lebanon has its own long tradition of relatively free press, and we wondered how the recent protests and counter-protests are playing there. Michael Young is opinion editor for the Daily Star, an English-language newspaper based in Beirut and covering the Middle East. He joins us now. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we've been watching the massive demonstrations in Beirut, and some media here are covering them as part of a larger trend in the Middle East, implying that Lebanon was emboldened by the elections in Iraq. So how's the narrative playing out there?
Well, not really quite in the same way. I think it's being played mostly as a local story, an indigenous Lebanese story. It's not really being linked to events in the region. But the different television stations and radio stations are playing it up depending on their political outlook.
So some are giving more sympathetic coverage to the pro-Syrian Hezbollah-organized protests and others to the anti-Syrian protests.
Exactly. In other words, if you want to look at two particular stations, the station owned by the former prime minister, the late prime minister Effi Hariri, which is called the Future Station, and has obviously been, you know, interviewing opposition politicians, showing the demonstrations, etc. Of course, on the other side, if you want, you have the Hezbollah television station, Al Manar, playing up the Hezbollah demonstrations, actually acting as a mobilizer. But there is variety, even in those stations owned by specific politicians. The freedom of information in the market, and it's quite extensive, essentially imposes on everybody to be much more open towards news, to try to shape it less to fit their particular agenda.
On the other hand, the director of the Institute for Professional Journalists based in Beirut said recently that the Lebanese media lacked ethics and professionalism. You reported her words in your own newspaper, The Daily Star. Do you agree with her?
I would tend to say that in the Lebanese press, where you do see a problem is in the independence of the media. You do not see often hard-hitting feature stories that, you know, in a sense will take on the state or that will take on a particularly sensitive subject. But that doesn't mean that you don't have a lot of very interesting stuff out there, often very critical, very open. It's a mixed bag. I would not say there is a lack of professionalism. I would say that our approach to journalism is rather different than in the West, but it can often be just as compelling in terms of getting the information across.
How is the approach different?
Well, today, of course, is not a good time to judge because obviously all the taboos have been broken with the Syrians apparently leaving Lebanon, so that it's much more easier to call a spade a spade. But in the past, to give you a very concrete example, you would not say the intervention of the Syrian intelligence services in such and such an event. They would use, in Arabic at least, the more ambiguous regional intervention in such and such an event. It was very clear that they were referring to the Syrians. So, I mean, it's a work in progress, and I think that the latest events in Lebanon have liberated the press from the language of the past.
But, as you mentioned, Hariri owned a television station, and he was also prime minister. In fact, his assassination has led to all of this new attention on Lebanon. And I just wonder whether some of those old journalistic problems have played into the coverage at all.
There is no doubt that Hariri's television station today is sort of the rallying point of the opposition when it comes to the audiovisual media. There is no denying this. But let's look at the two options. Either the station can play that role, and it's not an objective role. But the second option is one that basically, if Hariri station is not playing that role. Well, no one else will be playing that role either, so that in fact the opposition will have no say. Let me give you again perhaps a more concrete example. 2 years ago, we had a by-election in one of the mountain regions of Lebanon. And at the time, a particular television station called the MTV was instrumental in bringing out the opposition vote. The candidate supported by the government, in fact, lost that election. And the response of the pro-government crowd was to effectively close down that opposition station. And it still remains closed. So what I'm essentially trying to say is that you're absolutely right. These are not necessarily always objective stations. But the fact that they are broadcasting allows a certain portion of the population to have its views voiced. So that in a sense, you have a paradox in Lebanon. You have a lot of often subjective stations, but this breadth of point of views allows everybody to have his say in the system.
Michael Young, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Young is the opinion editor for the Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon.
This week in Amman, Jordan, a reporter named Hadi Ansour from the daily newspaper Arad was arrested by government security agents after his controversial story linked a local lawyer to a deadly suicide bombing in Iraq. It's a touchy subject, and the facts of the case are murky. But one thing is clear. The immediate blame fell on the messenger, which in Jordan, despite rhetoric about flourishing democracy, is an alarming trend. 6 weeks ago, in the first press conference of his second term, President Bush was surprised by a question about another episode, the jailing in Jordan of Islamist firebrand Ali Hattar for publicly criticizing the United States.
You've asked me to comment on something that I didn't know took place. I urge my friend, His Majesty, to make sure that democracy continues to advance in Jordan. I noticed today that he put forth a reform that will help more people participate in future governments of Jordan. I appreciate His Majesty's understanding of the need for democracy to advance in the greater Middle East.
Well, yes and no. The Kingdom of Jordan, a longtime ally of the United States, is one of the more progressive Arab nations. His Majesty King Abdullah, like his father King Hussein before him, has deep ties with the West and a constitutional monarchy with highly visible elements of democracy. An elected parliament, for instance, and a declaration from the king himself that, where freedom of expression is concerned, quote, the sky's the limit. Alas, that sky fell on Ali Hattar, who was jailed for criticizing Jordan's alliance with the United States. It fell on the weekly Al-Masht, which was closed after it printed criticism of a Saudi-Jordanian oil deal. It fell this week on Hadi Ansour, the journalist arrested for his Iraq suicide bombing story, just as it earlier fell on Ansour's colleague, Mohammed Jayousi. That young reporter filed but could not publish an innocuous piece about a Jordanian minister visiting Israel for a trade negotiation. I asked him,
is it because people object to him doing business with the Israelis?
Yeah, sort of, yeah. The government was embarrassed, and also they will move the public opinion towards the act against the government.
The king has said that the sky is the limit, but this statement has not really been translated into action.
Daoud Khattab is a democracy activist and founder of Amman.net, an internet radio station which, in his words, is doing something completely illegal in a legal way because the 24 laws restricting the press don't cover online content.
There's criminal and there's emergency laws, there's state security laws, there's commercial laws, there's slander laws. So the journalists write something that's bad, they can basically drag you to the court. So it becomes very difficult to really do things in the investigative reporting area.
Or in any other area. It is illegal to criticize the king. It is illegal to offend neighboring Arab states, or any other country for that matter. It is illegal to discuss security issues. And certain social issues are taboo as well. This is Radio Fan, a new independent station, where executive manager Nadine Koresh delivers Western and Arabic pop music and brief news breaks to a youthful population with no place to turn when real life intrudes beyond the top 40.
Like any country, we have our set of problems. I'm sure you're very familiar with the whole honor killing thing. Drugs. Nobody knows what the drug problem is in Jordan. I'm sure there's a drug problem. Sex in terms of sex before marriage, sexual problems during marriage, sexual molestation, incest, a lot of issues that people have a lot of reservations about.
And so, Radio Fan doesn't get into all that. Not that it necessarily would, it's a music station, but it takes care in its news headlines to ruffle no feathers whatsoever.
Don't criticize the king or the government just for the sake of criticizing. Don't be provocative, but other than that, you say whatever you want to say.
In Jordan, by law, but also by habit and it seems native temperament, some things are deemed just none of the press's business.
Sometimes we'll have to take national interest above any other consideration.
Samir Barhoun is editor of the Jordan Times, an English language daily which, like its Arabic sibling Al Rai, is 65% owned by the government Social Security Agency. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 represents absolute freedom, Barhoun estimates his paper operates at about a 7, covering the news without interference, so long as it doesn't intrude on state security or the affairs of other Arab nations. His paper has occasionally tested those boundaries, but he's not especially eager to discuss that on tape.
Are you sometimes frustrated by the constraints about what you can print?
Sometimes, yes.
Can you give me some examples?
No.
Much of the Times' domestic content is provided by the state-run news agency Petra, which dutifully records all of King Abdullah's doings and reports them directly from the palace, knowing that those accounts will be run by the Times, Al Rai, Jordan TV, and Radio Jordan, more or less verbatim. I asked Barhoun if the Jordan Times wasn't therefore, in effect, the house organ of the royal court.
There's nothing wrong in being house organ of the royal court. The king is ruler of the country, and he is the head of all authorities on Jordan here.
Radio Fans, Nadine Koresh.
You know what? We would much rather have him or that entire family ruling this country for the next 500 years than having, you know, a democracy and elections, and then God, who knows who's going to win, and maybe you have somebody that's extreme in his thinking. And no, we're very happy with the system we have.
Ah, the elephant in the room, radical Islam. Better to have a monarchy you know and love than a democratically elected Islamist who democratically reinstitutes the Middle Ages. On the other hand, the history of Muslim thought is the history of incorporating religion into all aspects of life. And to Ibrahim Izzadeen, the thought of trying to separate religion from politics is absurd.
I don't think you are going to see any moment in our history that people who teach Islam that they are not going to involve themselves in political, economic, and social issues.
Izzadeen is the chairman of Jordan's Higher Media Council, which this month will issue a report of the year in Jordanian press freedom, a report that is filled with horror stories, but which nonetheless leaves him guardedly optimistic. The very fact that his council has been commissioned to document government transgressions and to lobby for press deregulation, he says, is encouraging in itself.
No government would like to be criticized, but the most important thing is to draw a balance and to have bodies like our body that could mediate and could say whatever should be said in a very transparent manner.
He points to some small victories, changes in laws to permit books to be published without government review, to give journalists more and timelier access to the bureaucracy, and soon, he believes, to end the jailing of reporters for journalistic transgressions. He also predicts the licensing of more independent media companies. One such is Dawood Kitab's Amman.net, which averted prosecution by transmitting online to the neighboring West Bank, where Palestinian radio stations broadcast his programming back into Jordan. Now he has been awarded an FM frequency in Jordan.
The license is restrictive. We can't do news and politics, but still it's not clear what news is and what politics is. So we will be doing a lot of local community-based programming that we will not call news, but it will be local programming, local issues. And we think that we will be adding a little bit to the experiment, which is to help in the internal struggle.
That's the struggle within the Jordanian government between liberal thinkers and the old guard. King Abdullah is reputedly allied with the forces of change, but based on the current state of affairs, no one can be sure.
He does need to walk the walk. He cannot just talk the talk. It's his government that is making the laws. It's his government that's enforcing the laws. It's his government that is putting people in jail for their opinions. It is his government that still owns and controls the main radio and television station. It's his government that still owns 65% of the major newspaper. So it sounds good when he's in New York and London and in Washington, but he can't speak one way outside and then act a different way inside.
can't, maybe Khattab meant to say shouldn't. The fact is, and maybe the problem is too, that for free expression in Jordan, the sky is not the limit. The limit is the patience of His Majesty the King. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Susanna Dillaplane and Nick Gilowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Beidel Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.